Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia, beaming out to you on the 5th of February, 2014. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another show. In the first hour of today's show, I'm bringing you a replay of our interview with Amber Lyon, former CNN reporter, which I think you'll find very, very interesting. In the second hour, I'm bringing you a new exclusive interview with investigative journalist Jerry Georgiatos, who will be talking to us about the Chappelle Corby case, as Chappelle's release appears to be imminent from recent news reports. So I'm going to cross now to the interview with Amber Lyon, but do stay tuned for the second hour if you're looking for some new material, because our interview with Jerry Georgiatos will be extremely interesting. Amber, I'd like to talk about your recent background in what you've been doing and the recent book you've written. But I'd actually like to just kind of step through your background as a journalist and what led you to the point of becoming, you know, quite unusual, bit of a dissident, someone who kind of stands out from the crowd. You were with CNN for quite a while. Can you just tell us about how you got into journalism and how all that panned out?
Yeah, I've always really felt the need to stand up for the little guy and give a voice to the voiceless. And that's why I found the path to investigative journalism, because it's an amazing profession and it really gives you the ability to make a tremendous difference through documentary work or through my written pieces. And so I was a documentary filmmaker, and CNN, some producers there had seen some of my work, and I ended up getting hired to work with them as an investigative and documentary correspondent. And I worked with CNN for 2 years and was really able to produce some incredible pieces and travel the world and doing what I love, which is investigative journalism.
Wow, yeah. And your work has really highlighted a lot of the concerns that many people have about the way in which the media is co-opted, the way in which information from the major corporate media is really giving us kind of shaping public opinion as much as it is actually giving information. And sometimes it's very hard to tell to what extent it is actually just really shaping public opinion as its main function. What's your feeling about that from what you experienced with CNN?
Well, I think it's people should be hard-pressed to trust any mainstream outlets. I think right now there's a big confusion going on between journalism and propaganda.
Yeah.
And journalism is printing what someone else doesn't want printed. Everything else is propaganda. And unfortunately, because a lot of these media outlets are corporations, their main goal is to make a profit, and they're putting that over journalism. And I saw that directly at CNN. When I found out, while one end of the building, I was working diligently to expose a brutal dictator regime in Bahrain, at the other end of the building, CNN was actually taking money from that same regime to produce what I call infomercials for dictators, these sponsored programs that really highlighted Bahrain and made this regime look very positive to the viewers. And that was very disturbing to me at the time. And I actually whistleblew on that event, because it was so disturbing to have such a major news network taking money from these regimes, governments worldwide, in exchange for producing positive content. That's just not journalism.
Absolutely. And of course, your whistleblowing then led to your leaving CNN not long after that. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I am now an independent journalist, and I am I feel very free as an independent journalist. I think it's nearly impossible right now in the United States, working for any of the major mainstream outlets, to conduct investigative muckraking journalism.
Absolutely.
Because the corporate interests have just been put ahead of the journalism.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people wonder how this actually takes place, because, you know, I've spoken to many journalists within media, within newspapers, within television, and many people deny that there is any kind of censorship like that going on. And those of us who are kind of more of a conspiratorial mindset are often led to really believe that there is just a vast conspiracy, and that in fact these organizations are just sort of taken over top to bottom. But
I think the reality is somewhere in between that, isn't it? It's like, I mean, there are people like you who are in these organizations who actually try to do the right thing and sometimes succeed. You did a documentary on Bahrain, which you were able to produce, even though it was suppressed, but you were able to do that. What's it actually like when you're in these organizations? I mean, how does the censorship get applied? Is it more self-censorship, or are there actually like men in smoky rooms that kind of take you aside and tell you what you've got to do?
Well, what I think is going on is there's just an attitude sent through the newsroom from the top down to try to censor certain stories. For example, during the Occupy movement, the attitude sent through the CNN newsroom was that Occupy was annoying and that viewers had had enough and we need to focus on other stories. And as a journalist who knows historically this was a tremendous time of protest in the United States and journalistically we should be out there covering it and giving a voice to these people, I saw that that was a mistake and I fought and really pushed to get Occupy covered. That's because I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
And I saw a lot of my colleagues give up. And I think that's just what happens in these newsrooms when the feeling is that the story's annoying and we shouldn't be covering this. When that's sent from the top down, people just give up. I also just found in some circumstances, like with my documentary on Bahrain, they just didn't air it on CNN International.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so no matter how hard I tried as a journalist to produce quality journalism, it didn't matter because at the end of the day, they just didn't air it. And I think that's the problem because it was very frustrating for me and exhausting to try to get quality journalism on in this network. But I am so stubborn, I didn't give up.
Yeah.
But I think what happens is just a lot of people just give up or they leave and go independent, which I saw a lot of my colleagues do as well.
Yeah, and you were willing to do that. I guess it's a bit of a risk. There's certainly less money to be guaranteed, and you were willing to do that. Yeah,
that is true.
But the passion has to be what drives you, doesn't it? I mean, if you're not passionate about what you do, then of course, if you see your work as simply being a career, then I guess you will toe the line. Is that what you find with a lot of the people who are working within these organizations? I mean, where is their passion?
Yeah, well, that's what I that's what I would wonder oftentimes because I was trying to find allies and help and it was difficult to find. And I think that's because, unfortunately, the passionate people are being driven out of the business because they can't get their stories on and it just bothers them so much that they have to leave. And the people being left are the yes men. And that's dangerous journalistically. We shouldn't have yes men. Journalists are supposed to be muckrakers by nature. And the journalists remaining in many of these outlets are just the yes people. And that's disturbing. And also recently Seymour Hersh, who won a Pulitzer Prize, wrote an article, an op-ed in The Guardian, and he said really to reform these major networks, you're probably going to have to fire about 80% of the producers. And I agree with him because the passionate people have been driven out and the people who are left are good journalists, but they're also yes men. So that means they're not fighting for these important stories to be told, nor are they exposing it when their stories are being censored.
Absolutely. And it just makes it all the more important that alternative media continues to develop. And, you know, one of the problems there, I guess, is that your media, to do it properly, is a resource-intensive activity that really requires a lot of technical skills, a lot of knowledge, a lot of equipment. And that's why the big, well-funded networks are able to do it, is because they have the money. But when people like me, I'm doing a little show here, really on the smell of an oily rag, I'm extremely limited in what I can do. And because I'm limited, I can do great interviews, of course, but I have a great difficulty getting the information out. And so we have this problem with, try as we may, that we want to break through, and in many ways the corporate media is losing grip, but we have a problem with a financial model for the alternative media to some extent. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, but I would also say it's a promising time in many ways for alternative media because you do have the capability somewhat to get your message out there, whereas maybe 10 years ago that wouldn't be possible. I've seen some independent journalist friends of mine just start websites, one of them being Ben Swan, benswan.com,
yes,
and
yes.
He's able to take donations from the public directly and actually succeed with crowdsourced donations, whereas 10 years ago that would have been impossible. So some of these dinosaur gatekeepers are becoming irrelevant, but you are right that they still have a stranglehold on the market, and it still is difficult for the independent press to compete. Although we're getting a little closer to being able to compete, fortunately.
Yeah, of course, in Australia, Amber, we have a fairly tightly controlled media environment. There are really only sort of two major commercial news sort of dynasties that run the television, radio, and newspapers in Australia. And there is, of course, the government-run media, which is also very, very strong in Australia. And I would say we are certainly subjected to an incredible amount of censorship, very similar to what you've experienced overseas. But we also have this this level of government-funded television broadcasting, which a lot of people think it's actually good, because they think, well, it's going to be non-partisan because it's the government. But in many cases, what I've found is that some of the worst propaganda of all is coming from these government institutions. And I would compare our ABC, for example, to the BBC, and I'd be interested to know what your take is, say, on the BBC.
I am not that familiar with, as far as like censorship or anything, but just because I didn't work for them directly.
Indeed.
So I feel more comfortable just commenting on CNN where I work directly. Although, you know, I've heard complaints, obviously, that the BBC isn't giving the full story or did not give the full story leading into the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan and other major news stories where the public really needed to know the truth to make an informed decision. And so, but that being said, I didn't work from within. So
absolutely, but the feeling that we get is that all of these major large news organizations kind of dance to the same tune, and they seem to take their cues from Reuters and Associated Press, and so it feels like it's a top-down model, that basically there is someone deciding at the apex of the pyramid there what is going to be news.
And I you saw that with the Occupy movement in the United States. There was a coordinated effort between all the media outlets to just not cover it, and or when you did cover it, make it seem like it was irrelevant or that these protesters had no message. And I saw that in a uniform fashion in the coverage, and so it would lead you to believe that some of these heads of these networks are getting together and having phone calls and deciding what they're going to cover for that week. Although
we're just going to break, Amber. Sorry to interrupt. We're just going to break you with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. I'm talking to Amber Lyon, independent investigative journalist. Really important show. Stay with us.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio, and I'm talking to my guest, Amber Lyon, investigative journalist and author of a new book, which has just come out, Peace, Love and Pepper Spray, which is Amber's look at activism and protest in America over the last few years, and it's a coffee table style book, and it's obviously got a lot of graphic images in it, and documents a number of recent protests. And Amber, I'd like to actually get into some of the material there, but just while we're still talking about media and the range of sort of options that we have, one thing to note in Australia is that we don't have, as you do in the US, a diverse network of independent radio networks, because the government here has pretty strict controls on how you might set up an FM network. And, you know, for all of the bad things that are happening in the US at the moment, there is one great thing you do have, I believe, which is the wide range of independent radio networks. And this show is going out on one of those. My show goes out on the Logos radio network, which is a completely independent network that's actually run through private donations, people who set up radio towers on their own private property to allow the show to go out in the Austin area and in Oklahoma City. So I think that's a really important aspect too of freedom of communication, isn't it?
For sure, and I think it should be disturbing to the citizens of Australia that you're not able to have more independent radio networks, and that there is such a government stranglehold on the media. That should concern people. Why doesn't the government want more options when it comes to your choice of information? That's a question people should be asking themselves.
Yeah, I think a lot of it sort of comes under the concept of regulation, and they say, well, you know, we have regulatory bodies that make sure everything's done in a certain way. And we don't want to overcrowd the radio bandwidth with too many stations, and you have to apply for licenses. And of course, you know, they have community radio stations in Sydney, and I actually did try to get my show on one of them, but I was told, and this is quite funny, I was actually told I was too right-wing, and the fact is I'm not right-wing at all, but because I have certain views which some right-wing people subscribe to, they decided I was too right-wing and wouldn't let me have a show on their radio, on their community radio show. Isn't that interesting?
That is, and I, you know, it's just, it's disturbing. You should be able to have your voice heard, and that should be disturbing to citizens of Australia, that you have independent radio shows not being offered bandwidth.
Yeah. Well, of course, we are a fairly small country, and the lack of population leads to less diversity. But there is the diversity there, I assure you, and there's a lot of people in this country who are wide awake and would, you know, love to be part of something new, and that's kind of what we're doing on this show. Now, I'd love to talk to you a bit about the book. You've actually documented a lot of protests. You were actually on the ground at a number of them, and I was recently watching one of your recent interviews in which you were talking about the fact you were actually shot at in one of these protests in Anaheim, California. That must have been pretty disturbing.
It was. It took me weeks to get over that because I wasn't expecting it. I've traveled and covered protests in the Middle East and North Africa, very violent protests, and I was never shot at then, and I didn't expect it to happen on U.S. soil, but I was ironically covering an anti-police brutality protest, and I was in the middle of the street photographing, and a wall of police just started firing what they call less lethal rounds, but still, if one of these rounds hits you in the rib cage, it could pierce your heart, or if it hits you in the head, it could cause serious brain damage. And
absolutely.
And so a wall of more than a dozen police officers just started firing, and I had to run and hide between two trucks to avoid being hit for several minutes. And it was a shock to me. And when I emerged from the trucks screaming, "Press, press," one of the officers asked me if I knew how to cover a riot. And then I said, "Yeah, I've covered a lot of these." And he said, "You need to stand back there behind the police line." So I believe they deliberately fired on me to try to intimidate me, because while I was not behind the police line, I was gathering images for my book of pedestrians who had been hit by these less lethal rounds, and really documenting the blood and the tragedy that these officers were causing on the streets of Anaheim by just firing indiscriminately.
Indeed, and this protest had been triggered by police brutality in the first place, hadn't it?
Yes, police shot and killed an unarmed citizen, Manuel Diaz. He was a 25-year-old, and it was in broad daylight in the middle of a neighborhood, and police had approached him, and he ran away. He wasn't armed, and they just fired and killed him in someone's front lawn. And so the residents wanted to voice their anger and let the police know that this is unacceptable. You can't just kill our residents in broad daylight when they're unarmed. And so they hit the streets to protest. And unfortunately, instead of the police department apologizing and really taking responsibility, they responded with a heavy hand and put on uniforms that looked like they were headed to war, and really just started firing pepper balls and rubber bullets and foam pellets at these residents. And some of these protesters were children and women, and they were unarmed. And the police responded very irresponsibly. I've never seen anything like it. And I devoted a whole chapter to what happened in Anaheim, because I never want people to forget that this was allowed on the streets of the United States.
It's pretty shocking, isn't it? I mean, in this case, were the police provoked? I mean, did they have a justification for why they suddenly launched into this, you know, pretty militaristic sort of response?
Well, there was a bottle thrown from the crowd. We don't know where it came from. I was there, actually. I saw the bottle thrown toward police.
Yeah.
That being said, it was one bottle. And instead of responding and trying to find the individual that threw that bottle, they just started, everyone just pulled their guns out and just started firing all across in a 360 degrees around the circle, just firing down the streets. And some of the people whose injuries I documented were just happened to be walking home from the bus stop from work, and they were hit. And and the police were walking up and down residential neighborhoods in lines with their guns drawn, just firing down these streets. You saw residents hiding on their front porches, peering out their front doors, just terrified. And there was no repercussions. There was no outrage from the public.
Really,
I've never seen anything like it.
That is really. I actually wasn't aware of that. Believe it or not. These rubber bullets, as you say, they can be lethal. And were there any deaths as a result of this?
There were no deaths, but there were some pretty serious injuries.
Yeah.
I documented a man who had been hit in the head by one of them, and it split open his head. He was bleeding everywhere. And a woman who was hit in the back of her legs, and she had wounds the size of a quarter that were just gushing blood. And and so, I mean, it was serious injuries, but no one was killed, fortunately. But the fact that they felt the freedom to walk down this residential street and just start firing indiscriminately, and the fact that they weren't punished for doing so, to me, was very disturbing. And also part of a larger trend I noticed in this book covering protests, that's a trend of police militarization in the United States. We're seeing our police dressed more and more like they're headed to war to police protests that consist of unarmed citizens. And it's disturbing because it's intimidating these citizens and keeping them from exercising their First Amendment rights to protest.
Yeah, the stuff that they're wearing, the costumes and the armor that they're wearing, just create the fear factor in itself, don't they? And then just sort of have that chilling effect. And you say there's a trend, so you actually perceive in the time you've been sort of watching what's going on that this is actually getting worse in America. It's not just like we're now seeing what's always been there. It is actually moving in a direction which is heading more towards brutality, more fascistic in its outcome.
Correct. Unfortunately, it is. And the more I started covering the protests when they started in September, and I covered them until the next September, and by the time I got toward the summer of that year, it was pretty a regular occurrence at these protests to see.
We are just going to break here with Truth News Radio Australia. It is a great pleasure to be with you today. We'll be right back after this short break. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. My guest is Amber Lyon, and we're talking about the slippery slide towards totalitarianism in the US. And Amber, you've certainly documented there some very, very disturbing trends in the US. And I have to say, it's very similar in Australia. And just as an interesting comparison, I'm actually in Thailand at the moment. And what I've actually seen in Thailand is that there is a massive protest going on here in Bangkok, which is it's involved hundreds of thousands of people. The organizers say it's over a million who are on the street at any one time. And what I'm amazed at, Amber, is the incredible tolerance that the authorities here have towards it. Because I know in my country, whenever there's a protest of more than about 10,000 people, the police response is overwhelming, and they usually have just massive. They get the riot squad out. They're fully armed. They treat it as like a threat to national security. And it's what I find interesting about that is that people always talk about the Western democracies as being the homes of freedom, unlike other countries, other bad countries in the world that don't have our tradition of democracy and freedom. Whereas what I'm actually seeing in Thailand, and of course there's a lot of problems with the government here, and I'm not saying the government here is great either, but what I notice is that there is an acceptance of people's right to publicly dissent. A quick take on that.
And that's really impressive. And I think we've been led by the media, surprise, surprise, to believe that we have this somewhat false sense of democracy, because I believe that when you are in Australia or in the United States and you're just trying to simply hit the streets and voice your anger and you're met by police dressed as if they're headed to war,
yeah,
that are intimidating you, then do you really have the freedom to protest and express your opinions? I mean, is it really a democratic country when they're trying to intimidate the populace and keep the populace from dissenting? And that's disturbing. And I find it really interesting, your comparison to Thailand. Have they not been, have they brought out riot gear at all? Or?
There was some tear gas used on one day. Now, these protests have been going on for about 2 months, and they gradually got bigger and bigger. And the one that I went to was absolutely massive, and it looked like a million people to me, but I couldn't say for sure. But it was absolutely massive. There was not a single police or army there. And that was about 2 weeks ago. After that, the authorities did actually start cracking down a little bit. But still, compared to what we've seen in the US, mm-hmm. It is just so incredibly tolerant here, and this is why I think unfortunately people are in a mindset of believing that they have freedom when in fact they don't. And in a way, it's the media that's helped continually perpetuate that illusion, isn't it? Because the media is always telling us that we in the Western countries, the democratic countries of the world, there's kind of like this connection between countries like the US and Australia and the UK and Europe and Canada. And we think, well, we're the good guys. And it almost goes back to a meme that sort of goes back to the Second World War and kind of how we were the allies fighting against fascism, and it's sort of been propped up through continuous propaganda ever since then.
They want us to believe we're exceptional. Australia's exceptional. America's exceptional. We believe in democracy, and it's this cycle of propaganda that unfortunately the majority of residents have fell victim to. And that's another reason I published this book, because I wanted people to see and really question, do we really have freedom in this country? When just a couple dozen people hit the streets to voice their anger that their neighbor was shot and killed by police in broad daylight, and they're met by police dressed in camouflage with combat boots carrying huge guns pointed at them. And that is really disturbing. And to me, what was more disturbing as I was covering these protests across the U.S. was the lack of outrage by the media when police showed up at these protests dressed like they were in some kind of Judge Dredd movie. You really didn't see any pushback from the media. And the media's job, they were acting like lapdogs. They should be watchdogs against authority. The media's job as journalists, we're always supposed to be on the side of the people, always questioning the government and instead, you're seeing them really on the side of the government and authority questioning the people. And that's where we have a problem with our media.
Absolutely. And we need people like you who've, you know, professionals from the mainstream to cross over. And that's why, you know, just I'm so happy that you exist.
Really. I'm a rarity. I had a lot of colleagues who were really upset with what was going on at CNN. And at the end of the day, I've learned a lot of things about human nature through my whole experience, because at the end of the day, they weren't willing to put their neck on the line and expose this injustice, even though they knew that's really the elephant in the room at a lot of these major media outlets. It's not the investigations, the individual investigations these reporters are covering. Really, what the reporters need to be doing is turning around and investigating their own companies, because I believe these media companies are causing a lot of problems worldwide, and it's really disturbing.
Absolutely. And well, on this show, you know, we look at a lot of what appears to be distorted information on many, many topics that often seems to have a corporate link to big business or business interests. And what I find, I mean, you talked about CNN doing sort of infomercials for Bahrain. I see the media doing infomercials for a variety of corporate interests, and you know we've looked at various things going on in medicine and the treatments of diseases and various things like that, and genetically modified foods, the current global sort of situation with climate and climate change and carbon trading. There are so many issues which the media is purporting to be there to tell us what's going on, but they appear to be shaping opinion constantly. And what I find is that all I can do is to somewhat, you know, counteract what is coming out by continually calling them out in what I see that they're doing that is just sort of blatantly untrue. I mean, what else do you think we can do? I mean, it sometimes becomes, you feel like you're being a little repetitive because you have to just keep saying the same thing over and over again.
I know, there's so much disinformation out there that it just gets so frustrating. And now you even find out, recently we've had revelations that potentially one quarter of activists aren't even real. They're just being made up by intelligence firms to create more disinformation and lead us to a false sense of foreign policy. And so I think the key is to just continue to call them out. I mean, because no one else is doing it, for sure. And really, I, like I said before, I think I'd be hard pressed as a viewer or listener to trust any major mainstream outlet, especially the ones that are being run by governments, because they're being run by governments.
Absolutely.
So you know, we're supposed to be investigating governments, not letting them run media outlets.
And Amber, do you have a show of some kind at the moment? Are you sort of regularly appearing on television or radio?
I've just been out promoting my book, and then yeah. I'm in the process of starting one, which is right up the alley of combating disinformation. I'm starting that at the end of February, and that's going to have a lot to do with prescription medications and alternative medicines that are available that are more effective and offering people other solutions to all of these medicines that really aren't functioning as medicines, but are more functioning as addictive drugs.
Absolutely, yes. I know you've done some work on there on looking at hallucinogens as a medicine. I'm really interested in talking to you about that. I'd love to get you on the show again sometime to go through more material, but I better let you get back to your holiday. It's been great talking to you today. Really, really great pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your efforts. I'm grateful for you and for your work, and please keep it up and hang in there. It's an uphill battle we both have, but we're winning. I feel the tide shifting, and really we have more resources with social media and the internet, and we have so much power that we didn't used to have as journalists, and so that gives me a lot of hope.
Thanks so much, Amber Lyon, and I will hopefully speak to you again.
Thank you.
Truth News Radio going to break. We'll be right back after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to the show. Well, I hope you enjoyed that replay of the interview there with Amber Lyon, and I do hope to get Amber back on the show to actually look at the research and the new work she's doing into the use of psychedelic drugs. It's certainly a different area, and one that could be a gateway to knowledge and wisdom. And I think we always need to be looking forward. We need to be thinking beyond where we currently sit and the way we currently think, because there are certainly boundaries, there are limitations in terms of the way we even grasp reality that have to be superseded, I think, if we're to advance individually and collectively. And when I say advance, I also mean advance on a spiritual level. At the moment, so much of what we're engaged in, those who are engaged in this struggle for truth and justice around the world, it's on a very primal level. I mean, we're engaging with with behavior and a mentality which seems to be really mired in very lower, you might say, lower chakra aspects of the human being. And we really do need to get beyond that. We need to get beyond this business about the culture of lying and the culture of power. You know, these are all lower base aspects of the human potential, and it seems to me that humanity is kind of struggling at the moment with being weighed down in this. And those of us who are trying to break through the lies, what we're really trying to say is we want to move society forwards. We want to move the level of consciousness forwards. And when we focus on very, very specific issues, like we're going to in the second hour of today's show about Chappelle Corby, you have to understand that we are trying to break through. We are trying to break through a barrier, almost a force field of deluded and deceptive ways of thinking that have been foisted upon us by an entire culture. And I would like to, in this section of the show, just explain to you really from a gut level and without a premeditated set of talking points. I want to explain to you the importance, as I see it, of the Chappelle Corby case. In any case where there is a victim of injustice or someone who claims to be, there is always an element of confusion and uncertainty when we look at the issues and we look at it from all different angles. And quite often this confusion is actually a product of the way the subject has been diluted or derailed in the discussion of it. And just to give you an example, take the Kennedy assassination. It is very hard to focus on the Kennedy assassination and come up with any sensible conclusions, because there is so much information and most of it is disinformation. And one can only conclude that that this disinformation was created deliberately so that you would in fact be compromised in your ability to come to a conclusion. And this seems to be a technique. It is simply a technique of throwing people off. And it involves creating a variety of false narratives. It involves using the media to throw into a general discussion viewpoints that actually have no basis in fact whatsoever. But because of human nature, those who do that know that certain types of gossip will simply be repeated and repeated and repeated, and people will end up saying things that have no basis in fact as if they are common knowledge. And in the Chappelle Corby case, an example of that is you'll find many, many people talking about how they know, how that there is a general discussion, and they've met people who know, who've talked to other people who know, that the Corby family is involved in dealing drugs in the Gold Coast. Now, you'll never be able to find the source of that. It'll always be someone told somebody else, but it's proliferated as an urban myth that everybody knows that the Corbys are involved in selling drugs. Now, if you actually dig into the story and try and find the source of that, you will find that there is actually no basis to those claims. It vaporizes as you begin to look for it. There is simply no shred of evidence to back up the claim that the Corby family is involved in drugs. But when we get to the question of Chappelle's guilt or innocence, the question of the Corby family becomes extremely important in terms of the way people frame the whole question. Now, this is a topic I'm going to be considering in a lot more depth in the interview coming up with Jerry Georgiatos. But just reflect upon it for now. That isn't it rather odd that in the midst of all of these allegations and all these rumours, that Chappelle's sister Mercedes has lived in Bali in close proximity to Chappelle, and there has been no police interest in her. The authorities there have never arrested Mercedes, despite the fact that Mercedes herself was the subject of incredible allegations that were aired on Channel 7. The authorities in Indonesia and the authorities in Australia never took any interest in this. And indeed, there never has been any solid evidence that would stand up in court that suggested that Chappelle had a network of drug suppliers in Australia, and that she was actually connected to any form of drug trafficking. Now, normally, when someone is put on trial for trafficking a large amount of a prohibited substance, and we're talking about 4.2 kilos here of marijuana in Chappelle's case, normally, the question of where it came from is a pretty important part of the investigation. And it's also a very important part in proving that this person really is guilty. And this never occurred in the Indonesian trial. The entire trial and conviction of Chappelle Corby is simply based on prima facie evidence. There aren't even fingerprints to connect her to those drugs. There are no forensic connections whatsoever. There is no video footage that would show her lumbering with a heavy bag that was too heavy for a boogie board bag at the airport, despite the fact that her defence specifically requested that video footage. Now, there are dubious characters who've come forward and said that Chappelle's father had been involved in drugs. But again, none of those claims resulted in any police investigations. They simply resulted in ongoing media hype. And in the end, a book was even written by journalist Eamon Duff called Sins of the Father, which many critics have said is virtually a novel. It's really just a work of fiction that is loosely based on the life of a character. But this character of Mick Corby may or may not bear any relation to the Mick Corby that was Chappelle's father. I would say it bears very little relationship to that. And that's because I've actually looked into the sources. I've looked into the claims made by the primary sources that informed that book. And I discovered that they have no credibility whatsoever. Now, in addition to this lack of evidence, we also have a tendency in the media to constantly portray Chappelle as someone who is doing quite well for herself, who is maybe dramatizing the problems that she has in jail. And a recent report came out again on Channel 7, or was it Channel 9, I'm not sure, which indicated that the prison that she's in is actually quite a lovely place, and that it has all kinds of classes you can do, and a lot of the prisoners there are happy. And then they talk about Chappelle and they say, well, you know, Chappelle doesn't seem to be happy with it, but all of these other prisoners have said it's a lovely place. I mean, literally, this is the way they have depicted Chappelle and Kerabokan Prison. Now, anyone who knows anything about prisons in Southeast Asia or prisons generally would know that has to be rubbish. I mean, prisons are never places that are very nice. But Kerabokan Prison is a particularly nasty place, and there are a number of books that highlight just how nasty it can be and just how dangerous it can be. So, unfortunately, this deluge of misinformation about Chappelle Corby has really poisoned the minds of, I would probably say, most Australians. Yet despite that, Chappelle is due to be released soon, and I think there is going to be a resurgence of interest in the case. So with that, we'll be ending this hour of the show, and in the second hour of the show, Jerry Georgiatos will be coming in to talk to us in depth about the Chappelle Corby case, and he'll be revealing very important new information that he has gleaned from government sources that I think you will find quite startling. So that's Truth News Radio Australia. Do stay with us for the second hour of today's show. Very important interview coming up.